Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 21st. We are in the fireside room of Koinonia this afternoon. Your presenters' names are Drs. Cliff Hall, Peter Cleaver, and David Cleaver. The session number is 99-5. They continue their topic, Faith and Medicine, with today's session, Medical Ethics, End-of-Life Issues, and Physician-Assisted Suicide. Let's listen in.
Start off with, first of all, just to find, kind of finish up yesterday's. If anybody had any last questions or points they wanted to make about prayer, faith, and healing, feel free to ask those now. Otherwise, we'll start moving on. Anybody have any last questions? Okay. Before we started today's topic, which is end-of-life issues and ethical issues around that and physician-assisted suicide, I want to make kind of an observational comment, and then we also want to talk about something that's a little bit different from that. I've taken care of a number of you medically, and this kind of ties into yesterday because I've been very, very impressed by how you take care of each other. I've seen some real compassion and caring, and it's really impressed me and touched me, and I really want to point that out because I think maybe that's a key to your longevity, that you are caring and compassionate people and take care of each other. That's the first comment I wanted to make. And then Cliff also wanted to talk a little bit, and I wanted to talk a little bit about what happened with Louise last night. Just as an example, she has given us permission, if that's still true, to just talk a little bit about how, use her case, not specifically, but just kind of as a background on how we make medical decisions in emergencies, and what kind of things we think about and balance when we have to make a decision in medicine. In her case, there was a number of issues. You have to look at the medical issues, just on their face value, whether somebody is serious in their medical condition, certain things like head injuries, how well they're thinking, but also what's going to happen to them, what you think might happen. Now, it's a lot of guesswork in that, educated guesswork, but also trying to decide the risks and benefits in anything we do. And just like as if we were suturing somebody up, I have to explain what the benefits of suturing is versus the risks of it. And we only do things in medicine when the benefits outweigh the risks. And in her case, we had to decide whether her medical condition warranted a risky evacuation at night. Obviously, there's a lot of things that go into evacuations of people, but they're especially risky at night when you're considering flying somebody out. Flying into these mountains at night in a helicopter is a very dangerous thing. So you have to weigh that against what you think the benefits might be of getting her out. And could we elaborate more on that?
Yeah, I think almost everybody here knows what happened to Louise last night. She's a woman in her early 70s. Who has been healthy. She's took a bad step last night and fell and injured her leg. She fractured her hearing aid. She got a laceration on the side of her head. She appeared to have lost some consciousness, got a bruise on her lip and some contusions, and immediately afterwards was a little bit confused because she had been really clubbed pretty hard in the head by a rock that came up the same speed that she came down. And Dr. Cleaver was called to assess the situation and to do some of the things that he just talked about. The evaluation, we'll just take this from a medical perspective, the evaluation showed no focal neurologic problems. In other words, there was no evidence of a stroke or no evidence of any brain damage at all or anything of that sort. He gave her a DT shot, which she needed, and he gave her a couple sutures to repair the laceration, cleaned up the wounds, and assessed the situations, and found that she just wasn't thinking quite as clearly as she normally did, or actually nowhere near as normally as she did. And the concern from a medical perspective are three things. One, was there some kind of bleeding into the brain? Could that have occurred? Could there have been a damage to the blood vessels around the surface of the brain? So there's an intracerebral hemorrhage, or there's something called a subdural hemorrhage, what we call an acute subdural that would come on over a period of hours, or something called an epidural hemorrhage, which is the most serious kind of hemorrhage, when an artery all over the surface of the brain can be disrupted and the blood can accumulate over a period of time, where you're knocked unconscious, you wake up, and then 30 minutes or an hour later, you may lose consciousness again, and that's a neurosurgical emergency. That has to be drained right away, or else it will lead to a death. So Dr. Cleaver had to assess the situation and consider what the options were, and the options really were two. One was to observe her here, to watch her, to make a decision if she got worse, to then transport her, or to go give an immediate transportation, either on emergent basis, have a helicopter fly in, or urgent basis to get her down to the dock and get a boat. And of course, this is dark at night, and those things are not necessarily easy to accomplish. How does one go about making a decision? And I think this is what the points that we wanted to just sort of bring up, just to show what a physician, what we have to go through when we make decisions, and we do this on a daily basis, and this is one of the things that happened last night. There's the purely medical decision, and that would be, we don't care about you as a person, we just care about what's happening as far as your brain goes, and what are the risks and what are the benefits there. And if we looked at you only as a brain and some blood vessels around the brain, then we would say, no question, you should be evacuated to a medical center that has neurosurgical capability, that has CT scans and MRI scans and all the high-tech things that are available, if that were the only issue we were dealing with. But there are other issues that we deal with. We deal with what the patient cares about, whether the patient says, gee, that's just what I want to do. I want to fly out of here. I haven't had a nighttime helicopter flight in years, you know, and I want to get down to Wenatchee because I hear it's a nice city this time of year. So her wishes, the patient's wishes and concerns certainly come into play. And, of course, one has to say, well, is that person have just been knocked unconscious and hit on the head? Are they making rational decisions? Do they really know what they want? What do friends and family feel, and how do they think the care should be given? Peter has already mentioned the potential community risks of running a boat down that has to use radar to get down the lake and not crash into another boat or into a rock or something down in the lake, or a night flight, which has tremendous risks. You can imagine flying into this valley with a helicopter in the dark of night, you put other people at risk. Other things, relative probabilities. If what's the chance that this really is a life-threatening illness? Is it 1% or 2% or something like that? And if it is, what is the chance that having neurosurgical capability is going to really make a difference and lead to a good outcome? It makes a difference whether someone is 10 years old and fallen off a bicycle and hit their head, or whether somebody's 70 or 80 or 90 years old and has hit their head, in terms of what the potential benefits are. One of the things that we hate to admit to, but does play a role, and that is, what's the threat of malpractice? What's the concern of risk if we say, gee, what if we make the wrong decision here and somebody comes back and says, second guess us down the road? And we are generally judged not on the humanistic and the spiritual and the friendship and the personal concerns, but rather purely on the medical decision making. So there's a certain pressure on your physicians to make a decision based on that basis. Insurance coverage. What if it won't cover evacuation costs? We didn't even get into that last night, and we didn't feel that was really an issue that we should be concerned about, but that is an issue that does come up if you have an HMO or if you have a certain coverage that does provide for some of these issues. And finally, and sort of tied in a little bit with the malpractice thing, is, in my opinion, and what physicians have done for hundreds of years, is what's the role of just reassurance and comfort in terms of what's best for the patient? How do we enlist those other humanistic, those personal, those spiritual kinds of healing powers that are there, and how do we enlist those, and how do we encourage those, and yet not get ourselves into trouble with respect to the lawyers and the malpractice? Because I think the best thing that anyone could have said to Louise last night was, you're going to do fine, you're going to make a good recovery, Because at that point, the blood pressure goes down, the adrenaline level goes down in the circulation. If we say to her, gee, we're really worried about you, and we think we ought to put you in a helicopter and send you down to Wenatchee so you can get a CT scan and be real close to a neurosurgeon who might drill a hole in your head, I can guarantee you that her blood pressure goes up, that her adrenaline goes higher, her heart beats faster. And what do you think that does to the risk of bleeding? If you already have damaged the blood vessel and suddenly her blood pressure goes from 120 over 80 when Peter says you're going to do great to when I say or someone else says, oh my goodness, this is serious business, and you suddenly run a blood pressure up to 160 or 180 or 190 or even higher because of the adrenaline, you actually increase the risk. So the best thing to say to her is everything's going to be fine, but you don't know that. And from a medical legal point of view, that's the worst thing to say to somebody, is that you have to tell them all the risk, all this kind of stuff, simply because if you don't tell them that, then you haven't given them informed consent and you run a greater risk of being sued. So you see the kind of problem you get in here. Fortunately, we have somebody like Pete Cleaver here, and it was his call last night, it was his decision, and I kind of watched this from aside, and this was it was very reassuring to me to see a recently trained or relatively recently trained young physician make very intelligent, very excellent judgments and come to a conclusion that the best, taking all these things into consideration, and so it's not a simple thing, well, you know, A equals B and therefore you do C, but takes all those factors into consideration and makes a decision. So we've talked about you, Louise, but I think it's sort of a very, as someone who just watched this thing unfold last night, it was certainly an example of how one can practice really high quality, excellent medicine way out here in the boonies with very little support in terms of diagnostic tests and things of that sort, but just making good judgment and enrolling this other arm of medicine. That there's the technical and the scientific, but there's the humanistic that we can draw on our own healing powers and emphasizing that to have what fortunately is a wonderful outcome. And we're happy you're doing so well.
Thanks to all the nurses you had last night, too.
Yeah, I think that is really, I mean, your initial comment is such an important one, because you were able to stay with your friends. You'd come up here with friends. You stayed with your friends. I think they were a tremendous support to you.
And they were the Steel Magnolias.
That's right. And we mustn't forget prayer.
Absolutely.
That's right. Did anybody else have any questions about that, or how decisions are made, or anything along those lines? What we're going to move on to now is some end-of-life issues. What we're going to discuss first, Dad's going to talk a little bit about this. He's had quite a bit of experience, obviously, in dealing with people who are at the end of their lives, and talking about especially making your wishes known through a legal document. And he's going to talk a little bit about that. And he's actually given talks on this quite a bit. So why don't you go ahead?
Well, before I do this, I thought I should tell you a little story. This is a story about an 85-year-old retired college professor who is usually taking his daily walk with his dog when in the distance he saw one of his old-time buddies coming down the street. He said to himself after he looked at him, he says, my gosh, I've known that fellow all my life, but I just can't remember his name. And to think that I just had lunch with him yesterday, played 6 holes of golf. As he got closer, he still couldn't recall his friend's name. And he said to his buddy as he got up to him, you know, my friend, I know you, but I just can't remember your name. I know I had lunch with you yesterday. We even played a few holes of golf. His friend scratched his head, looked up in the sky, looked at him, hemmed and hawed a bit, and he said, how soon do you want to know? They smiled, and then they laughed, and then they parted. These two old friends accepted their infirmities and had a good laugh. Life is generally better when we come to grips with the reality that we are not immortal, and that as we get older, our bodies and minds will age. I like something that I gained from reading Sherwin Nuland's book, which is, I think, a book that would be worthwhile for you all to read sometime. It's probably the best book I think we presented here. It's called How We Die. Humankind belongs to an ecosystem that is based on rebirth and renewal, with old lives passing away to make room for the new, like the falling leaves preparing the way for new leaves in the spring. When it is accepted that there are clearly defined limits to life, then life will seem to have symmetry and meaning as well. At this time in our lives, we really need to think of medical care in a much different way, and I think Cliff and Pete have alluded to that. I think, as Dr. Goodwin said, modern medicine does not work well for older people in many situations. The goals, hopes, and vitalities are quite different than at a younger age. And the risks and complications of medical treatment and technologies are much increased. This is somewhat expressed in the concern that most of us have about our medical future. In my experience, the elderly fear most the loss of their independence and the uncontrolled suffering that at the end they will wind up in a hospital, away from their family and friends, and hooked up to a respirator and saw all sorts of tubes in futile effort to prolong life. In recent years, there have been two major developments, I think, in medical care which have responded to these fears in a major way. I think it began with the hospice movement with Dr. Cicely Saunders in England, where she began the movement of hospice. That was in the early 1960s. And since then, I think the hospice movement has become not only a model for terminally ill people, but also for the elderly as well. It's a compassionate care that enables patients to reclaim control of their lives, and understanding that each individual is unique, a recognition that comfort and happiness are important, and that there are times when attempts to prolong life are inappropriate and futile. In 1990, the United States Supreme Court recognized the constitutionality protecting the right of individuals to refuse unwarranted treatment. In other words, patients should have the right to decide what treatment they would have. The subsequent Federal Patient Self-Determination Act requires that all federally and state-funded providers of health care inform patients of their rights to refuse medical and surgical treatment, to formulate an advance directive to that effect. Now, both Oregon and the federal law give every competent adult 18 year or older the right to make their own health care decisions, including the right to decide which medical care or treatment to accept, reject, or discontinue. In 1993, the Oregon Health Care Decisions Act requires that patients who refuse life-sustaining treatment shall be provided with comfort care, including appropriate medications to relieve suffering and pain. It is now legal to give pain medications to relieve suffering, even if the secondary result of that treatment results in death. if, for example, a person, because of his disease at the end of life, has uncontrolled suffering that gives you the feeling of suffocation, you can give them morphine, which would surely, in that situation, in the dosage necessary to relieve it, probably will result in death. But you're primarily treating the suffering. In times past, physicians were disciplined by the Board of Medical Examiners for prescribing too much pain medication. And I know Cliff and I've experienced calls from the medical examiners in these situations, resulting in many patients being undertreated. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association last year found that 1 in 4 elderly cancer patients in nursing homes received nothing for their pain. That's astounding at this time. But times have changed. This month, in Oregon, an Oregon physician was disciplined by the Board of Medical Examiners for not doing enough to relieve 6 patients' pain, marking this the first time a state board in the United States has taken such action for giving too little rather than too much medication. It's a whole change. But we're talking about times when you can make your own decision and you're competent. But what if you're incompetent? Who makes the decision? Is it the nurse? Is it the doctor? Is it a judge? Or is it a committee in a hospital? We used to have living wills to handle that, but they weren't really, a physician or a caregiver wasn't necessarily required to follow that. Now, in many states, including Oregon, has developed their legal documents or directives that enable you to state your choice for medical treatment and care, or to point someone to make these decisions for you when you are incompetent and unable to do that. These are legally valid decisions, and healthcare providers are obligated to carry those requests out. So in other words, if my wife is my representative and I'm not able to make decisions, she makes decisions just as though I would have made it. And the doctor follows those instructions. Then the decision is not left to a judge or a committee who may not know you or your wishes. I bought copies of the Oregon Advanced Directives, and we can just probably pass those out. The first part of these Advanced Directives give you sort of a description of what the advanced directives are about. But in these directives, you can specify that you give your representative the right to make a decision to withhold treatment, to remove a respirator or IV tube feedings. And it's specified in there. You can also signify that you don't want that decision considered. Now, this is just sort of a short form for as far as I'm concerned, because there are a lot of things I want Gene to understand and want my doctor to understand what I want done. So I've written a 2-page expansion on my advanced directives and how I want decisions made. I've conveyed to my family, my doctor, exactly what my concept is of the reasonable and acceptable quality of life. And I think the acceptable quality of life determines what decisions were made, just as though I were competent. And for example, if I'm not competent, I've stated in here, if I'm not competent and in a nursing home, I can't make my decisions, my representative will assess my quality of life in terms of what we talked about before. And then if the quality of life is not acceptable, I request no transfusions, no hospitalizations, no antibiotics, no surgery. Now, I'd like to have Cliff and Pete perhaps comment on this.
I'd like to just expand just on the Dave's two-page directives, in addition to filling out the official forms. I think it's a wise thing for all of us to write a letter to our spouses or our kids or whoever, our best friend, maybe to all at once, just outlining some of the things that Dave just said. Just discussing some of the values about what you think your life has meant and what you think you would like to have happen toward the end if you became incompetent, when you weren't able to make decisions. Not necessarily in great detail, because you can't possibly think of every possible question that might happen. You don't know if you're going to get run over by a truck, or if you're going to have a stroke or a heart attack or whatever is going to happen to us toward the end. And that doesn't really, and that's not the important issue. The important issue is that you conveyed to your family members so that it makes it easy for those who are going to be in a position of making a decision to say, yes, Joan didn't really want all these things done. It's obvious here, and it makes it very comfortable for the decision making to take place. And a copy of that can go in your medical records. A copy of it can go in your medical records at the hospital, so that just in case you show up in the emergency room sometime, there is just that additional information. That can be very comforting. And a point we made in one of the earlier discussions a couple days ago, if you do advance directives, and if you name a power of attorney for healthcare, it will never get to a point where there will be a big fight or a hullabaloo or go to court. And these things are almost never used. That's the beauty of them, is that we almost never does a spouse have to come in with a form and say, I have the right to make the decision, because it is so obvious that the family knows that these issues have been discussed, that there has been an understanding and acceptance, and that there is a sense of goodwill within that group that's making the decision. It's when it's never discussed. It's when suddenly one of us ends up in the hospital and all our kids have entirely different ideas about what kind of care we want. So I think your point is a very good one, David.
And I should indicate that in my billfold here, I have a little card that states that I have I have advanced directives, that it indicates who my representative is, who my physician is, and that I've got a document in my records at the hospital and at the Corvallis Clinic. I think this is not just simply a piece of paper. As Cliff has indicated, it should be used as an opportunity to get your family to sit together and talk about it. The first time I brought this up, and I was trying to define what I meant about personhood and when I wanted the plug pulled, and one of my kids, I won't say who, said, gosh, Dad, let's not talk about that now. You know, you've got a long life ahead of you. That's the point. We all want to be comfortable about this. And when you get comfortable about it, you level it. Life is finite. And you get across to your family and your doctor how you feel about it. Cliff and I have talked about this lots of times. And where we disagree, I just say, you've got to do what I tell you.
He's always said that to me. Says that to you, too.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? Those of us who are alone, I think some of us at least, have a worry
about if we have to call 911, and we have said that we absolutely do not want any extreme measures, we do not want CPR, but yet, if they come into your house, what are they going to do to you? How can you stop them?
Don't call.
Well, yeah.
No, it's not as easy.
Yeah, it's not as easy as that, because there's a lot of medical conditions you may want to get care for emergently that aren't necessarily the same sort of things as being intubated or shocked. It used to be, and it's true, that paramedics and people in emergency medical services had to respond in the same way every time by doing everything they're trained to do. Now, it varies from state to state, but most, as far as I know, most states now have, those paramedics have the ability to call their base station if somebody has directives and get approval from them to not do those things. So it's not the same as it used to be. You still run the risk, depending on where you are, of having those sort of things done and how sophisticated your emergency medical service system is. And I'll tell you, a lot of paramedics are still very nervous about not doing the things that they're trained to do because they don't feel comfortable with making those decisions. But they also have the capability of contacting their base station to get the approval. I don't know if you have more information on legalities, but that's my understanding. When I've had patients call, sometimes we have advanced directives. I tell them to go ahead and call 911. The paramedics can call me, and I can tell them not to do those things.
In the state of Washington, a directive has gone out to all emergency services in the last 6 months that they are to check, and if you have a wristband that says do not resuscitate or around your neck, and that's the first place they'll check for things they do not have to resuscitate now.
And you should know, I mean, if somebody does something knowingly against your will, it's a criminal matter. That's something that physicians have to consider, that when you forcibly do a treatment to somebody that they don't want and have made that known, that is battery. So it goes both ways. You get nervous on both sides. But yeah, it's much better, it's much more acceptable now for them to not carry through on all they do. The other thing I would make a comment on, in this day of video, I've suggested to some people that they actually videotape themselves reading their statement and then telling people what they want done. And that has a lot of force if you have some people in your life who just don't want to let go of those things. I think that's very important. It doesn't negate the fact that you should have this all in writing, because the writing part of it is what can be stored and transferred much more carefully. But I think as far as letting your family members know and people who have a hard time with these decisions, it's much easier for them when they see you and hear you say it.
Right, but that piece of paper,
that's the piece of paper, is the most important thing.
You know, still, if they can't lay hands on it, what's their hand?
That's why you've got to get as many copies as you can, and you got to have an indicator such as a bracelet or a necklace that says you have that, or a card in your wallet that identifies the fact that you have that and where that's located. A lot of people I know, patients who are really adamant about this, carry it on them. Were you going to talk to them about how to choose your advocate? Because it doesn't necessarily have to be a family member.
No, it doesn't have to be a family
member. In some cases,
that
might be better.
But I think it's, you really have to choose someone who you can rely on, who understands who you are, how over the years, how you have felt about things, and somebody whom you trust. Well, I've got somebody right here. So that was very easy. Do you have any other comments?
Well, you just have to, I think it's really important that when you choose, especially a durable power of attorney for healthcare, somebody who's going to actually be making decisions for you in very difficult spots, especially if there's somebody who really cares about you, and in many cases that's important to have those people, that you sit down and you be as realistic with them as you can, describing exactly what you don't want done. Because it's one thing to talk about this on, you know, sitting down over a cup of coffee. It's another thing to actually be in that position when your loved one's dying and have to make those decisions. So they almost have to go through a mental exercise beforehand. It's really important that they do that so that they know that they're comfortable. And you need to make them know that if they don't want to be your healthcare attorney, to let you know, because it's important that you get somebody who does feel comfortable with those decisions. Because they can go back on those things sometimes and out of emotional, just the emotion around that. So it's important to be frank with them and they to be frank with you about it.
If it's somebody who knows you well, that has shared part of your life in some way and understand, and sometimes children are not the best people because they scatter around the country and around the breed, and they always have an image of the parent as the parent that they knew when they were a kid, not the parent that has aged. But if you have someone who's a good friend or a spouse or someone that has a real sense of what you and the values of your life have been, then it is not a difficult process. It's a quite easy process because they know you, they understand some of your values, and when you talk to them about this, they say, of course. I mean, I wouldn't want to be hooked up like that either, or I wouldn't want my life prolonged under those circumstances. Because you often share those values. It's unlikely you're going to, if you're somebody that wants to be your life prolonged at all costs, that your best friend is going to be someone who feels entirely opposite. That's not the way, although you may have differences of opinion, it may not be quite way off, and you have a much greater synchrony.
But if you pick someone who's a good friend, likely would be the same age, and 2 weeks before you,
they might not be there.
That's why in many of these documents you have a secondary person.
Did you discuss the difference between no hard measures against the not resuscitation?
Well, we don't really use the term no heroic measures anymore. A do not resuscitate is a very broad directive that we primarily occurs, say, when you're admitted to the hospital. And generally, in the general terms, when I say do not resuscitate, I specifically talk about being intubated, having electrical shock to the heart as the two main ones. When I write a do not resuscitate order, that's generally what that means. And that's what I specifically write in the note in the chart in the hospital. We don't specifically talk about do not, we have to be more specific in these and lay out more different options and things that might occur in directives, just because the do not resuscitate order, as far as I use it, is more of a hospital term that I use to indicate an order that a patient doesn't want specific measures to occur to them.
And the resuscitation implies, very explicitly, that if you don't institute those measures immediately and fully, that the individual will die. Or in many cases, in essence, the individual has died. They've lost their life support signs, their hearts and ventricular fibrillation, they've stopped breathing. And if you don't institute immediate resuscitation, it really is resuscitation, not just treatment, then the individual's gonna die. That's a very clear-cut, very narrow issue, the resuscitation. That's a very different issue than what most of us are thinking about, are these much more difficult questions, such as, I've had a stroke and I can't move my side and I can't speak and I can't swallow and I'm going to have to go to a nursing home. Do I want a feeding tube in to keep me alive? Or because I can't swallow, I can't eat, I can't take liquids. So am I going to have a feeding tube or have intravenous hydration? That's a very much more difficult kind of question. How bad is the stroke? Are there other ways to communicate? And so you get into issues that become much more gray, much more complex, much more difficult than the do not resuscitate issue, or the issue that you were referring to when the EMTs arrive and your heart stops beating just when they happen to be there in the kitchen with you, because you would call them about your broken leg or something. So they're the very difficult issues, and then the ones that seem to be a little more straightforward.
The Oregon.
There's a question.
What is your definition then of no heroic?
I'm sorry.
What is your definition then of no heroic?
We don't usually use that term.
That's what I got online, so I kind of
okay. Yeah. Well, what's your definition of no heroics? I guess that's what's more important.
Yeah, it's important that you have that laid out
well,
in some term.
If I have no ability probably to be other than a vegetable, I don't want to be a vegetable.
Sure. Well, you know, you make a really good point, because it's not so much the treatment, it's the goals. It's the goals of therapy. It's what are we trying to achieve? Because you might consider, if you have no reasonable hope of recovering from a condition, that giving you food and water is heroic, when that's really very basic. But in terms of keeping you alive in a condition that you don't want to be, it's just inappropriate. So rather than use the term heroic or not heroic and get into how the technical aspects of what the elements of care are, it's much better to think in terms, what are the goals of therapy? Is to restore you to a certain level of functioning that if you can't get to that level, whatever that level is, and each of us probably is at a different measure. But if you can't get to that level, then you don't want anything done. I mean, I may feel that I just don't, if I'm going to be in a nursing home and I can't speak and I can't communicate and I can't take care of my bodily functions, that I don't want to have my life extended in any way. And that includes food and nutrition and fluids.
Antibiotics.
Antibiotics if pneumonia comes along. Whereas someone else might not feel that way. And I think we have to respect the differences in what people want. But it's the goal. It's not so much it's the treatment supports the goal, as opposed to saying, well, this is heroic, or this isn't, or whatever.
Yeah. Is that resuscitation, though?
Well, right now, if I have a heart attack, right?
Your definition here for us, that we're hearing, yeah. But what does it mean to some medic someplace else?
Well, in the advanced directives that we have in Oregon, it's fairly specific, and I think the emergency room people know this pretty well. Now, in this directive, you can indicate that you don't want tube feeding, and you don't want any life support for these conditions. If you're close to death, if you're permanently unconscious, if you had advanced progressive illness with no chance for recovery, extraordinary suffering, it can't be controlled.
I haven't read that yet.
Those are pretty specific.
But you don't always, people always don't fit into those categories.
Well, that's why it's good to
write
a concept of what you want done. That's why I've written a two-page description.
I think one of the things that I see wrong with the term heroic is that it implies that it's always something positive and noble. And I got to tell you, there's been times when I've resuscitated people in the hospital over a prolonged period of time with multiple medical conditions that I've felt anything but heroic. So you have to understand that while some of these resuscitation matters like cardioversion and intubation can sometimes bring people back, the quality of life afterwards is not always, doesn't change the basic condition they had beforehand. It doesn't always bring people back, and in the majority of cases it doesn't, including people in the hospital. And you may not have the same quality of life, including brain function afterwards. So those are all issues around resuscitation specifically that we have to discuss when anybody's admitted to the hospital.
One thing to recognize is that there is only one medical procedure that the medical profession assumes, and the legal profession, assumes that you have agreed to in advance, and that's resuscitation. Well, none of us can go and remove your gallbladder or even put in a stitch in your forehead without asking for permission. Will you allow me to do this? These are your risks, these are your benefits. But we assume here that unless you tell us to the contrary, everyone here wants to be resuscitated. And that's the only procedure in medicine. That's the most dramatic, and the reason for that, I think the reason for that, is that we don't have time to ask, so one has to act immediately, so society assumes, And the legal profession has assumed, and the medical profession has assumed, that everyone wants it. So when you go to the hospital, if you don't want it, if you've said, make sure right from the beginning you tell your physician.
I feel it's really important that any time your physician admits you to the hospital, that they discuss that with you again. And especially somebody who doesn't know you should be discussing that with you when you go into the hospital. Or this gets into a much stickier area when you're going in for a procedure or surgery. You need to let those people know what your wishes are.
But just remember, if he discusses it with you,
they assume
it's on the record that you're a full code. Right. That means everything will be done if your heart stops beating. Now, that may be entirely, if you're going in to have an ankle repair, and while an anesthetic is being given, your heart suddenly stops, you may very well just want an electric shock right across you, right back to normal
but
again. No
to
big deal.
Specifically say that.
No big deal.
Yeah.
Sounds like a pretty big deal.
Okay. So go ahead, Dad.
We've been talking about a patient's control of his own life or her own life, patient autonomy. Now, Oregon has taken another step uniquely in this country in terms of patient autonomy, and that's the Oregon Physician Assisted Suicide. And it's a law now in Oregon, and it allows a competent, terminally ill patient to obtain prescription drugs to end his or her life when the quality of life becomes unacceptable or suffering unbearable with no prospect of improvement. Now this involves a big discussion, we talk about suicide, but it involves a big discussion of euthanasia, and I think we should probably define what we mean by euthanasia. Maybe you want to do that, Peter.
Well, euthanasia specifically, there's an active euthanasia, which is the physician actually being involved in delivering the mechanism of death. Jack Kevorkian has recently stepped over that line and has done that, where he actively gave the medication that caused the death of somebody. That's euthanasia. Whereas when we talk about physician-assisted suicide, we're not talking about the physician actively involved in the process. They might be involved in the means, which might be prescribing a medication or describing a method that the patient could use to institute their own death. So the patient still carries out the mechanism of their own death, but the physician just assists in that. I don't know if you want to go into any more definitions than that. This is what we're talking about here. We're not talking about euthanasia. We're talking about physician-assisted.
But we certainly can talk about euthanasia.
Yes.
It almost always gets dragged into it.
Yeah.
and we can talk about, just for terminology, Peter has mentioned active euthanasia. Mm-hmm. Euthanasia means good death. And that can be carried out... anyone who kills someone else in an act of mercy and with the goal of a good death is committing euthanasia. It can also be considered murder, and it is considered murder in every state in this country. But there's also something called passive euthanasia. So active euthanasia is where I say, Pete, you've had a good life, and I think that you need a good death, and I inject something into his vein, and he dies. That would be active euthanasia if the intent was one of out of kindness and goodness, and as opposed to just outright murder and assault, if it were just done with vengeance or a meanness. Passive euthanasia is the condition is a situation in which one withholds therapy, which would lead to death. Or withdraws therapy, which is life-sustaining. So that if an individual, and last night you heard of something similar to that, kind of might fall into that category, the woman that was extremely ill, was being supported by
machine, and that then the support was withdrawn. So that's a passive way of withdrawing support, allowing death to take place naturally.
And the courts, it used to be that it was fairly difficult to take somebody off of life support, which would be something such as a ventilator, that without they would die. The courts have recently been fairly supportive of allowing people in conditions that are hopeless, vegetative states, take them off those life support. They have not been supportive, obviously, of active euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, although Jack Kevorkian a number of times has been through the court system and has not been convicted.
So he's in jail right now.
Yeah, he's in jail now, but this is he's stepped over a different line in these cases, I think. So,
and when for every case that you read about in the newspaper of where a judge gets involved with the decision making and withdrawing, you know, we all have the fear that we're going to get hooked up to a ventilator and be kept on there. And, for every case that you read about, there are literally thousands of cases in which ventilatory support and heroic, I thought I'd say heroic support, but very vigorous technical support is withdrawn at the patient's wishes or the patient's family wishes or the surrogate caregiver's wishes, so that this happens very, very commonly and very frequently. So it isn't something that you should worry, spend nights about worrying that it's going to be a judge, that you're going to be another Karen Ann Quinlan case or another case where it has to go to all the way to the Supreme Court to decide whether or not we can disconnect the ventilator. The better you have communicated, just what we've been saying right along, the better you have communicated your wishes, your values, your goals to your family, to your friends, to the people who are going to be there at your bedside, the easier that decision is going to be.
Well, wasn't that case where actually people on the outside organizations were opposed to the removal?
That is another issue. If you're at a hospital that doesn't believe in doing, we mentioned that yesterday about the negative effects, maybe in some cases of religion and not necessarily always religion, other belief systems
like
that maybe.
Sure.
Yeah, there are friends of the court, so to speak, that are intervening.
But your representative from your advanced directives has the right to remove you from the hospital to another hospital and to another physician.
Sure. If you've signed to a, if you can't make a decision for yourself, first of all, if you can make a decision yourself, that overrides any court, anything else. You have that right. Number two, if you can't make a decision, you've signed an official document, one of these advanced directives with the power of attorney, and your power of attorney has also signed on that they will accept that, then that will override. So there's no, under a circumstance like that, there's no organization or anyone else that can override that decision. So there's a distinct order legal responsibility that takes place.
What we're talking about, I think, in the Oregon Physician Assisted Suicide Act, the first question is about suicide, the major issue. And you know, there are a lot of people who have problems with suicide, whether it's the right thing to do or not. But suicide is legal in most states, as it is in Oregon. So that's not a problem even to begin with about suicide.
Legally.
The big question comes about is whether Peter, Cliff, and I should participate in this. And I think there's going to be a little discussion on this side of the table about that. But it's a question about whether we should participate about it. Now, I think this was brought to Oregon by an initiative, and it was a hotly debated issue. And I have to say that being involved with this discussion, that there were really good people who fell on both sides of the issue. And there were moral and ethical questions that fell on both sides of the issue. And there's a lot of discussion. You can see the the arguments for and against in this little document we have. The initiative, should we talk about the...
Would you say a little bit about what the law does?
What the law does... Why don't you go ahead?
Well, in very simple terms, what the law says, that if you're an adult, you have to be an adult, you have to be a resident of Oregon, and these things are all defined, you have to have a terminal illness. And a terminal illness means you have to be certified by a physician that you will die, or you're expected to die, within 6 months. And that you have to be of sound mind, and you, so that you can't be either crazy or severely demented or not capable of making your own decisions. But if you meet those criteria, you can then request from your physician, or from a physician, request orally and in writing, and then orally again 15 days later, a request the means to commit suicide. So what this means is that if I have terminal cancer and I go to my physician who certifies that I do have terminal cancer, and I can then in writing, I say I want a prescription for some medicine that will kill me, and I write that in writing, and then I ask again 15 days later, and my written request has to be signed by two other people who certify that I am in sound mind, and so it can't be my physician, and it can't be an employee or the owner of either a hospital or a nursing home if I'm in one of those things. So it has to be someone else. It does not have to be a family member, but it could be a family member. And it may be that one person can't be a family member. It can't be two family members. There's some specific issues along that line. It may very well be, that's right. Or if it's the administrator of a HMO plan that doesn't want to pay for my health care any longer. So one has to be, those are, you have to be careful who's encouraging you to commit suicide.
You said one witness cannot be a family member nor an heir.
Yeah, I think that's obviously a safeguard in the program. And there has to be an additional consultation to confirm the initial diagnosis of the 6 month terminal state. If there's any question, and Dr. Cleaver has to offer to me some counseling or a psychiatric evaluation, I don't have to take it. If he thinks I need it, then I certainly have to have that as well. And he also requests that, and I think this is right, he requests that I inform my family members, but I don't have to inform my family members. I can do this just personally. And then I can get that prescription, and Peter can write out the prescription for a lethal dose of barbiturate, or which is the most commonly used medication. Tell me how to take it or how to use it. And that in itself presents a problem, because I can assure you that not one of us in medical school were told and taught, this is the lethal dose of the medicine. This is what you write. So the doses and the administration, things like that, that information is available. It's available on the internet. It's also available through organizations that are supportive of this process. But I can get that prescription and take it home and keep it on the shelf, and then I can take it at any time that I want to take it. So it can either be something that I definitely intend to use, or it may just be a security blanket that if things ever get so rough and I'm not getting the kind of pain control or the kind of relief from suffering, that I can then use that medicine.
And there's one more thing I'll just add. They also have to discuss all the feasible alternatives,
yes,
to a suicide, including whether getting enough pain control, whether there's some sort of hospice or other supportive network that might improve your situation. So all those things need to be discussed also.
If you're a physician that doesn't agree with this, and you're in Oregon, you do not have to.
If, as a physician, that's a very important point. you ask your physician for the prescription, the physician says, I, for whatever reason, I don't think you should have it, or I don't won't do it for anyone, or I just don't believe in suicide in any form, or it's against my religious beliefs, or whatever, that physician does not have to participate. Similarly, the pharmacist, when you arrive at the at your Walmart pharmacy with your prescription, if the pharmacist has ethical or religious reasons for not wanting to fill that prescription, he or she does not have to fill that, but the pharmacy itself has a certain obligation to fill it, so find another pharmacist. So you may have to go to another pharmacy just in terms of...
Certain hospital systems don't participate.
Some mental demented the reason you take it and get on I-5 and scream down there to you. Find a guy and kill somebody.
That's part of what you inform them not to do.
Sure. I mean, that presumably Pete has told the patient, after you've taken the dose, don't get into a car and speed down.
Just as if I'd given somebody a pain medication for a fractured leg, don't drive after taking that medication. So if I don't tell them that and they do that, then I am liable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you found that many are taking advantage?
We'll report on that.
You're going to talk about the
About how many and or how few, considering how many people there are in Oregon.
No, even exactly.
No. But there's another part I didn't mention. There's another part of the law. The Oregon Health Department. Any time that a physician writes a prescription for this, he has to report this to the Oregon Health Department. The Oregon Health Department keeps the tally and checks into this and obtains the death certificate and follows through with a follow-up. And this is all done with some patient confidentiality. There's been great concerns about the state and the government and everyone knowing about whether or not this is done.
They put
it's on the death certificate. Yeah. So we write, so if this happens, Peter, so if I commit suicide and Peter is given the prescription and Peter signs the death certificate, he will write a drug overdose, legally prescribed medicine. And then he will write down under that the terminal condition, the metastatic cancer or the terminal heart disease or whatever it was that was the underlying condition. Yeah.
If you opt for the Hemlock Society, you have to go through all of this. Are people that don't want to do all that?
This is just
that's a good point. A wonderful point. I mean, why, if it gets right down to committing suicide, why get the medical profession involved? Why get all these additional consultations? And what's this magic thing about 6 months? I mean, I would be even worse. Yeah. I mean, 6 months, at least you're going to be dead in 6 months. What if you're going to have this for 5 years? You're going to be in pain.
What about somebody, I've known people with terminal depression, essentially, people who've been treated with every possible medication, electroconvulsive therapy. Those people are going to suffer for a longer period of time. Should they be allowed to have physician-assisted suicide also?
Well, that, I should say, defense is my view.
Before we go jumping all over again. Okay.
This law isn't perfect in terms of its inclusiveness. But one of the reasons it's not inclusive is to avoid abuses. So it's been drawn up very narrowly, and I think quite carefully, so that there are going to be people that are left out on this. But maybe in the future we can figure out some way of including them. But right now it's pretty narrow. And I think we'll probably get down to the point where we discuss, I think, maybe later, whether a physician should be involved or not.
Yeah.
Do you want to do that now? Or?
Well, I think to answer your question.
In a case in point, in a town where my sister lives, a man just stepped in front of a heating freight train. He didn't apparently care to do all this, or didn't think it was a friend's father just put the gun and did himself in.
Now, neither one of those are Hemlock Society.
No, apparently not. Usually, if someone is determined to take their own life, they'll do it and not go through all this.
And there are, you're right, there's a tremendous amount of information on the internet about doing that. I think you know about other methods of suicide, such as carbon monoxide. I think one of the arguments for having healthcare practitioners involved in this, physicians, and putting this in law specifically, because this don't fool yourself. This has been going on for a long time before a law was ever passed. Physicians do this sort of thing. Is that we're, I think I'm trying to make my father's argument here, is that it sets some sort of framework so that abuses don't occur as might occur when, say, a physician made a decision on their own that this should happen. So that would be one argument why physicians should be involved. I personally don't feel like physicians should be. That's my point of view, which is different from many others.
At the risk of being a call, what happens if the person takes the prescription home and then dumps it on somebody else?
You married
you? And again, that's true of any medication that's prescribed.
Well, that's that would be murder. That would be murder. I mean, you, if you give this to your wife, I mean,
you're not blame
that. No. Just as with any medication, if we specifically tell a patient to use it in a certain way for a certain condition and they choose to not follow through on those instructions, and that's their responsibility.
Obviously, this is an attempt, as Peter said, the physician-assisted death and suicide has been going on in limited ways and still goes on, not only in Oregon, but in every state and in every country. And it's it hasn't been regulated, and how widespread it is, and how widespread it is and is occurring, is really not known, because the information is just not out there. But there is no question that individuals with terminal conditions and with conditions in which they are suffering a great deal, either in terms of pain or other kinds of stresses with their disease, have gone to their physicians and have requested doses of medicine which they could use to end their own lives. And sometimes they have done this surreptitiously. Doc, I need some more sleeping pills. And you know, though, that the Ambien and the Dalmane you gave me doesn't work as well as the Nembutal. Can I try Nembutal, which is a barbiturate? Now, it's hard to kill yourself with Dalmane. And it's easy to kill yourself with enough Nembutal. So if you just accumulated, you didn't take those as your sleeping pills every night, you just get your prescription refilled for 3 or 4 months in a row, you accumulate your little stash of medicine. And this has been going on for years and years, sometimes very with the physician saying, now, Mrs. Jones, you know that if you take 60 of these, you're going, that it could kill you. So don't take them all at once now, Mrs. Jones. And so as the prescription's written. And sometimes it's done with a physician having no idea that this woman or this man is really thinking about doing this. So this is an attempt to recognize it, to regulate it, and to put some safeguards into place.
It also offers an advantage in the previous, prior to the law. Often the patient died alone, taking the pills by himself. And it was considered to be an illegal act, which it was if the physician was involved. So it was kind of a secret thing. With the current law, it does enable the family, even the physician, to be there, because to be present with the patient when they die, particularly when they're conscious, just before death. Because one of the greatest concerns about people when they come to this time of life is that they're going to be abandoned. And that was one of the main objectives of hospice, was to provide a comfortable, family-oriented setting where you could die with your loved ones. And I think without this law, some of the people don't have that advantage.
Doesn't everybody have the advantage of hospice?
No.
Well, I can say a little bit about that. I'm currently chairman of the board of our local hospice, and it seems that this has been a matter of policy setting within each individual hospice, so that there are some hospices in Oregon that decided in favor of neutrality. In other words, if a patient decided that they wanted to do this, the hospice workers cannot act as any kind of an initiator of that action. They don't ask the doctor, they just keep a normal stance on this. And then when it comes down to somebody asking your doctor or physician assistant aside, hospice remains attentive to all their needs and will be there at the time of their death if they wish it.
I guess I would view in hospice as
available
and helping people, and I wasn't even thinking about the suicide end of this. I mean, I think a bunch of us are a bunch of cowards that we want to opt out of life when God gives us life and we think we're going to end it.
Well, I think you were the one that told me, Dad, that back in your practice that you felt that most patients, it wasn't so much, and I think this addresses that New England Journal findings, but it's not so much that they want to have control of their life. And many people will get this prescription and not even use it. It's just the fact that they have it and they have the ability to control that aspect of their life. And there are conditions, and I used to not believe this, but I have seen it, that are very difficult to control the pain. People really have such suffering that there really isn't a lot medicine can do for them. Now, that's not the majority of cases. I think that medicine has lagged behind their ability to really make people comfortable, and that's something we need to work on.
Yeah, I'm a little aware of that. My youngest daughter is an oncology nurse, and I've been in this situation, so I know.
I mean, I don't fault people at all for wanting to end that suffering. And I think that that's something each person has to make their own decision. What I have problems with is whether the physician needs to be involved in that. Another issue for me, and this might get to the New England Journal findings also, about what worries me is that our healthcare system is less than perfect, and we still have 40 to 60 million people in this country who aren't covered by health insurance. And I worry that financial aspects, burdens on family, burdens on finances will come into effect on their decisions about whether they would do this or not. And I think that until we have an adequate healthcare system that makes everybody comfortable in the end of their life and really provides all the things that we can provide to make them comfortable, not necessarily prolong their life, but make them comfortable at the end of their life, I worry that might come into effect.
I see two issues. One is just suicide in general. Is that ever permissible, or is it always a cop-out? Is it always a sign of cowardice of some sort? And then the issue of, if you say, well, under certain circumstances, suicide is not only reasonable, it's the appropriate way to have control. That is the question, does your physician get involved? David would say that if he has a physician, and he thinks he does, which may or may not be true, who is somewhat in tune with him, that understands him as a person and his values and what life means, and that he can have a discussion with me, or any of us can have a discussion with someone that we feel very close to as a physician, we have a relationship with, then under those circumstances, that person becomes not only the physician, but also a confidant and a consoler and all these other things that go into the healing process and can come to that decision together. That's really fine. But I would propose that if David had a physician whose income, and he belonged to an HMO, and I'm not knocking HMO, but the HMOs have done some good things, some very good things in terms of controlling costs and some other things in terms of getting some order into care that was running amok otherwise. But if David belonged to an HMO and he knew that his physician's income was determined in part by how much money was spent on taking care of David. Now, That's basically true with most HMOs, is that your physician, if you belong to an HMO, your physician's income is going to be affected by whether or not you have a major illness, especially an expensive major illness, and especially if it's one that's in a terminal phase. Are you going to trust your doctor who says, well, Dave, you know, you've had a good life. Have you thought about assisted suicide? Just casually throw that out, you know, and then Dave goes home and thinks about it. And when there's a real economic incentive for the physician, now I'm not saying any physician is going to do this, but
I hope not.
Do you even want to be in that situation? Do you even want any type of conflict like that? I have some grave concerns about physician participation in this process because of that. But Dave might want to tell us about how it's been received in Oregon and how thousands of people have lined up to participate. Sure.
Well, before I just want to mention one point. Before the initiative election was carried out, there were three different surveys of Oregon physicians. And the majority of physicians believe that assisted dying to be ethical and legal. Now, the first initiative election passed 51% to 49%. There were some of us, including me, who didn't vote for it at that time because I thought there were some problems with it. And the legislature, we felt, should have cleaned this up a little bit and made it work a little bit better, but they didn't. Instead, they chickened out and sent it back to the voters again. When it came back to the voters the second time, it passed 60% to 40%.
And how did you vote that time?
I voted for it. Now,
it had been changed
some. But the first year's experience was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, and to most of our surprise, the number was really quite small. It was, there were 23 people received the lethal prescription, but only 15 actually took it. There were several of those that didn't take it, died before they could make up their mind. Prior to these elections, and many people were concerned about many things that particularly pertained to the experience in the Netherlands. And I think that the initial experience, while it isn't a large number of cases, it illustrates that those fears, at least in the Oregon experience, 1 year, a small number of patients, didn't come true.